You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Lisa Boudet toku ingoa, no mai heere mai ki te wire mo tēnei rā. Hello and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday the 18th of July. My name is Lisa Boudet. I'm usually a simple producer, but I will be hosting your Wednesday Wire today and covering for Lillian, who is still having some bloody good time in Europe. In studio with me today, long-time Wire host Harry.
Hello.
Hi, and Dara Spreet's not quite there yet, but
she'll be here later.
Yeah, she'll be coming. How are you today?
I'm very good. How are you?
Good. A bit freaked out, actually, but yeah, it'll be all right. It'll be all right. All right. Coming up on the show today on Dear Science with AUT's Alan Blackman, we talk about ghost particles, old photographs and bread.
Yep.
Then Dara Spreet will be chatting with Generation Zero's Sid Mehta on this week's submission of the Zero Carbon Act to government, what it's all about. So stay tuned to find out. I will be reporting on the latest news from America, where Donald Trump is being heavily criticized for siding with Russia on the alleged campaign meddling. And Dara Spreet again unpacks the news that senior police are resigning in droves, while the government are trying to push for new cops. So she chats with Police Association President Chris Cahill and Police Minister Stuart Nash to uncover what's up. And that's for today. Remember, you can get in touch with us during the show. All you have to do is text us on 5395 or give us a call in studio on 309 3879. And now it's time for...
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, indeed. It is time for Dear Science with Alan. How are you, Alan, today?
I'm very well. How are you, Lisa?
Good. Good. Getting there.
All the kiddies are back at school, by the look of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah,
it's
no,
a very different place around here when the students are around.
So. Yeah, I was liking it.
The kiddie kiddies are still on holiday, though.
Oh, the kiddie kiddie. Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, yes.
Yeah, I was liking it when the campus was quiet. That was great. Don't have to wait in line. Yeah, don't have to wait in line for food. It was just great. Sorry, my microphone is actually falling down. It's pretty annoying. Anyway, science today. So, first topic, we start with something called neutrino.
Yeah.
And you wanted me to ask what it was.
So, what is it?
I think in the email you were like, you might want to ask what it is.
No.
So, what is it?
That was just a rhetorical question. But, okay, so you may remember, long-time listeners may remember back to about 2015 or so, and the big thing then was gravitational waves. And they managed to detect some gravitational waves that came from a couple of colliding black holes that were about 1.5 billion years away from us. And as a result of that, three people, I think, got the Nobel Prize in Physics last year. So this is possibly a discovery of similar magnitude. But what they've done is that they have used a neutrino detector to be able to pinpoint where in the universe this neutrino came from. Okay,
wow.
So your question, what is a neutrino? Okay, yeah. So we should start with that. Okay, so your atoms are made up of electrons, protons, and neutrons, okay?
Yep.
That's the Rutherford model of the atom. Sadly, there's a whole bunch of smaller particles that make up those things, particularly in the nucleus. And one of those is a thing called a neutrino. And neutrinos are really, really, really weird because of the fact, number one, they haven't got any charge, which is not quite so weird in itself. But the other thing is that they are really, 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 really light. Okay. And some people think, in fact, they've got no mass at all. Okay. So if you can get your head around the concept of a particle that has no mass, you're probably doing better than I am. Anyway.
And they're in the nucleus.
Well, that's an interesting question, actually. Yeah. Again, some people would argue that they don't exist sort of while they are attached to things, and then during radioactive decay, they then get spat out. In fact, during beta decay, which is the way that carbon-14 decays. But the amazing thing about neutrinos, okay, but that they're so tiny and they have no charge, so that means they don't interact with matter pretty much at all. Okay, and the story that's always told about neutrinos is that you can take a length of lead, a lead cylinder that is one light year in length, okay, and that's around about 9 trillion kilometers. Okay, now you know how you use lead when you're getting an X-ray, and lead stops all of those nasty X-rays, you know, so you're getting a mouth X-ray or whatever, you get a lead sheet on you, and that stops those particles. Okay, you can take this lead, this a cylinder of lead that's a light year in length, and you can shoot neutrinos down it, and half of them will come out the other end.
Oh.
Okay, so they really don't interact with matter very easily at all.
Yeah.
So what these people in the States have done is they've got a neutrino detector. They've built a neutrino detector. Gosh,
yes.
It's Wednesday at the South Pole. And this neutrino detector occupies about 1 cubic kilometer of ice, into which they've sunk these detectors that can basically detect light, essentially, or radiation. And they've got that all rigged up so that if they do detect a neutrino, it will immediately sort of tell people around the world that, yep, they've got that neutrino. We kind of know where it came from. Point your telescopes in this particular direction. Okay, and that's exactly what they did. And so that, so they're really, really lucky to see a neutrino. And it, and again, to sort of emphasize this, neutrinos are everywhere. They are hoofing through us at a rate of knots even as we speak. So roughly, for every square centimeter of the planet, there's about 65 billion neutrinos going through it per second.
That's quite a lot.
Yeah. So we through our bodies, we've got literally trillions of neutrinos going every second, but they just go straight through.
Yeah.
Okay, they just don't interact with anything. So it's very, very rare that you can actually get some sort of interaction of matter with a neutrino. But they managed to do this. They got this lone neutrino, which in order to see it had to have interacted with matter. So that's a very, very unusual and very, very unlikely thing to actually happen. It does happen, but it's very, very unusual. And they managed to get this at the South Pole. And then, as I said, within 43 seconds, the signal had gone to around the world saying, we've found a neutrino. This is where we think it came from. Point your telescopes in that particular direction. So we've got this orbiting telescope, which is a gamma-ray space telescope, the Fermi gamma-ray space telescope. And so it pointed its gamma-ray cameras in this particular direction, and they found where this neutrino came from. And so this was a thing called a blazar.
What is this?
I have to say I'd never heard of a blazar before. I'd heard of a quasar, but a blazar is essentially... It's a galaxy that's got a really, 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 really energetic core. And it's spitting out... Yeah, indeed. And it's spitting out lots and lots of particles, but it's spitting them out in the direction of the Earth, which is kind of lucky because it could be spitting them out in any old direction in the universe. And this is 4.5 billion light years away. Okay, this is you know, we're talking a long way away. And... and, you know, this is the first time that they've used this neutrino detector to be able to figure out where in the sky it came from.
Yeah.
And, you know, quite remarkable stuff. It might not sound like a big deal,
well,
but...
I'm just trying to find, like, the actual use of
Well, it's just really telling us more about our universe, I guess.
Okay. So this new galaxy, is it a new galaxy that we found, or was it we always knew it was
no,
there?
No, well, it was always there. It was just that, you know, you can now... say, right, this particular neutrino was given out
was
by that particular galaxy, and that's, you know, and that puppy's been traveling for, you know, 4.5 billion years at the speed of light, you know, and it ends up in the South Pole. So, you know, we're seeing that as it was 4.5 billion years ago, essentially, which always amazes me. All the light that you see from the stars emanated from them, you know, hundreds, thousands, millions, billions of years ago in some cases. So, you know, always amazed by that. So, yeah, this is very, very cool.
Cool.
So,
all right.
No pun about the South Pole there. No.
Oh, yeah, that would have been a good one, actually. I'm still trying to understand exactly everything that you just said. So that's why I'm not very interactive today. But we can move on to
not
a topic that I might have an input on. Who knows?
Yep.
So scientists have come up with a new tool that could help bring back all your old memories to life.
They could, as long as your old memories are daguerreotypes. Am I saying that correctly? It was named after a Frenchman, Monsieur Daguerre.
Daguerreotype, I think, is how we say it, but that's all right. that was close enough.
Well,
really.
No, it wasn't. It was terrible. Okay, so back in the early days of photography, in which the French were instrumental, essentially the first type of photography were these things called daguerreotypes.
That's all right.
And they... kind of use the same principles as, I was going to say modern photography, but now that it's all digital, it's,
Film?
I mean film, so it uses sort of the same, certainly chemical principles anyway, but the big difference that was that daguerreotypes were done on solid silver, okay? And the silver was generally on a copper background or something, but they were taken on solid silver. So these things were actually plates, and they were not particularly strong, so you could, you know, just a touch could actually wreck them and everything. So very, very sensitive and very, very fragile things. And the big problem with them was that because they're made of silver, they were prone to tarnishing. And so these came out, I think the first daguerreotype was around about 1837. So you can imagine that these old things would be very, very interesting from a point of, from a historical point of view. Anyway, you know, this is the foundations of photography. And so we can get to see, you know, photos from, hell, you know, 160, 70, 80 years ago. You know, this is, and but as I say, the problem was that a lot of them are in very, very poor condition now. And there's no obvious way to clean them up, given the fact that they're so fragile in the first instance.
Yeah.
So, how are they made? So, as I said, they were made by getting this sheet of silver, very, very finely ground sheet of silver, so it's very, very highly polished. You then expose it to iodine vapor. And what that does is turn the silver into silver iodide. And that's a compound. And silver iodide is what we call photosensitive. In other words, if you shine light on it, it goes dark.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's very, very similar to the normal photographic process, where in fact they use silver bromide, but what they do is they impregnate your photographic paper, essentially, with that. Yep. Okay. So similar kind of thing. And then what they do, they develop this using mercury vapor, which is not the best for you. So they take this thing after they've got the silver iodide, they put it in the camera, they expose it to the light, they then develop it using this mercury. And it's the presence of the mercury there that's all important, because what a scientist, a chemist actually in Canada has done is to now use a thing called a synchrotron to take these very, very badly tarnished daguerreotypes, which you really couldn't see anything of. You had a look at the pictures on...
Yes,
yeah,
I did.
Yeah, and it's utterly extraordinary what they've done. You really couldn't make out any picture. And what they do in this thing called the synchrotron is that they shoot very, very high energy X-rays at the daguerreotype, and they can then figure out where the mercury is on the plate. Okay, now in regions of very, very light area, there's lots and lots of mercury particles. In the dark areas, there's not very much mercury at all.
All right.
And so from the way that those X-rays interact with the daguerreotype, the different amounts of mercury in there, they can then build up a picture, literally, of what...
negative.
Yeah, essentially, yeah. Cool. So, of where the mercury is on the daguerreotype, and then basically make a picture from that.
That's
so
very impressive.
They're not physically cleaning up the actual daguerreotype, but what they're
recreating.
They're recreating it in digital form, and so they can see actually what's under all the crap. And as I said, the photo and the story on this was absolutely incredible. The only trouble, Okay, so synchrotrons are expensive puppies. There's about, I don't know, there might be 20 on the planet maybe, something like that.
Okay.
The closest one is in Melbourne to us.
Yes.
And you have to fight literally for time on these things. Getting 24 hours on a synchrotron means that you work for 24 hours, you don't sleep for 24 hours.
How long would it take per picture?
Well, that's the thing. So according to the work that this chemist did, this is 8 hours per square centimetre. So if these things are of any sort of size at all, then it's going to take an awful amount of time on an awfully expensive and large and well-used instrument to be able to do this. But...
Because who would have used it? Who would have wanted to use it? I suppose whoever works on old, like restoring old photographs, or
I would imagine so. Yeah, that sort of thing. But
they can't afford it.
Museums aren't the richest.
It's not the matter of affording it, because what happens? You can sort of ask for time on these things, and they give you in inverted commas, the time. You don't have to pay the actual cost for these things because they are upkept by, often it's the government who keep these things going. So it's just the sheer amount of time and the sheer number of people who need the time on these things. So, it, you know, your old holiday snaps and stuff like that, ain't going to work on those. But certainly these things that are of historical importance and are in very, very bad shape, I think this is an absolutely wonderful technique that has been used. So this was just published last week in the literature, and I'm sure that this is going to get a lot of attention. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see whether they can sort of apply it to other things as well.
But I was going to say, because it's obviously going to mainly be used for that daguerreotype photographs, yep. Which I suppose there isn't actually that many probably left in the world to look at.
Well, again, you know, the people were sort of bemoaning the fact that possibly many of these have been thrown out because they were thought to be irretrievable.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
So there might be some hidden ones, some private collections or some...
Yeah, okay. Yeah. One can only hope. Yeah. You could also potentially, I guess, use it for things like paintings. You know, often there are old paintings that are painted over something
multiple
else.
Multiple layers.
Yeah. And so, again, that's a common way that they can figure out whether there's something underneath them. So they simply use these x-rays.
Mm. What's under the Sistine Chapel?
Would like to know.
So yeah, I think that's a very, very nice application of really big science because I guess non-scientists don't possibly appreciate the sort of work that can be done by these very, very expensive machines.
So, nice crossover of art and science.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, the two are definitely related. So, yeah.
All right, thanks. So, last topic of the day, we are talking about bread. I'm actually really excited about that because I was watching this Netflix documentary the other day about bread and sourdough. And it was so fascinating about, you know, the ancient way, I suppose, of making bread.
Yeah.
I learned a lot about bread. And now you're going to tell us a bit more about how old it actually is.
Well, this is really interesting too. And this just got published again last week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, which means it's very, very important. And so there were a bunch of archaeologists from Denmark and the UK, and they were excavating a site in northeastern Jordan in a place called the Black Desert. And they came upon the remains of a fire, and so they were looking at this, and in addition to things like animal bones and stuff like that, they managed to pick up, I think, around about 20-odd bits of bread, basically, they were equating it to the sort of things that you find at the bottom of your toaster. So when you don't clean it out for too long.
Crumbs.
Yeah. So little crumbs of bread. And so they subjected everything to C14 labelling, radiocarbon dating, to try and figure out how old this was. And what they found was a date of around about 14,000 years ago. So this bread is 14,000 years old. Yeah. And this is a big thing because it's been thought that bread sort of came along with settled societies, because obviously making bread, baking bread, is a labor-intensive thing. Yeah. It's not the sort of thing that you can really do on the move, because you've got to harvest your crops, you've then got to grind it all into flour, you've got to have a mill, an oven, all of those sorts of things. And so it was thought that the oldest sort of historical evidence for bread was around about 8,000 BC.
Yeah.
Okay. And that was when the hunter-gatherers had sort of stopped moving around and when society had started sort of living in small communities and stuff. And now this sort of throws that into question, because now this dates at around about 12,000 BC. And so this is 3,000 years earlier than people had thought before. So it potentially a very, very big finding, and it might cause people to rethink things. You know, how did they go about making the bread when they're on the move all the time? As I said, you know, very, very sort of labor intensive, and not the sort of thing that you'd expect.
So are we thinking like different technique potentially to make bread, or...?
Potentially, who knows, really? That's, you know, that's the question that the archaeologists are going to have to answer.
Did it say anything about the composition of those breadcrumbs?
Yes. So they found sort of plant fibres in there that could have been, they couldn't say it definitely, but they said that it probably contains that barley, wheat or oats. So, you know, the sort of things that you would expect. Mm. So you know, a very, very fascinating discovery. And certainly for that part of the world, I guess bread does have a sort of a large importance, certainly sort of religiously, I guess, you know, culturally and everything. So,
and it's just everywhere, really.
Yeah. So I think that's a nice little thing to talk about and possibly to end on.
All right. So we'll let you go back to your classes. Have they started again?
Yes, they have started again. I've got a lab from 1:30 to 3:30 this afternoon, Foundation Chemistry Lab. So we're going to be heating up magnesium and that and burning it.
Ooh, cool.
They're going to love it.
All right. Hope your students are as excited as you are to talk about it. And we'll see you next week.
Okay,
thanks,
Lisa,
for coming.
Not a problem. See you guys.
Cheers.
See ya.
Thanks.
That was Dear Science.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
All right, we are going to play a little song right now, and then we'll be coming back with the rest of your news for the day.
were you at the gig on Friday?
What gig?
The Radical Maris Noise Collective. I never thought seven dudes playing saxophones would change my mind about capitalism, but hello.
That sounds
then
pretty...
2 hours of Nightcore remixes of Every Time We Touch.
What even?
And a white guy did a rap about feelings. So beautiful.
What?
What?
Stay in the loop with the 95BFM Entertainment Guide. Online and on air 7 days a week, three times a day. 10:20 a.m., 3 p.m., and 6:20 p.m. It's gigs in that.
You love music, right?
Yes, yes I do.
Then drive your stake into the musical landscape by voting for the 95BFM Top 10.
But how?
Text the word VOTE and your chosen band's name to 53955 or vote online at 95bfm.com/top10 before 6 p.m. every Wednesday. Then join Pearl from 7 p.m. as she starts counting them down. The 95BFM Top 10 with your host Pearl, Wednesday night 7 till 9 and always online at 95bfm.com.
The Wire.
Just before, you were listening to Queens of the Stone Age and their song God Is on the Radio. Remember, you can text us on 53955 or give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Now, it's time to talk environment with Harry. There you go.
Yeah, hello. So, this week, Generation Zero submitted their landmark Zero Carbon Act to Parliament after 2 years of extensive planning and negotiating from volunteers and professionals alike. The youth group are encouraging New Zealand to step up and lead the world in making New Zealand net carbon zero by 2050, an ambitious goal that the group says is more than possible. Earlier today, Dara did have a chat with Sid Mehta just to get all the information about the act and the processes that go on from here.
Yeah, sorry, I actually forgot that even though Harry came up with the idea, Dara actually did the interview. Here we go, listen to it.
Well, we first started off by, we thought that there was a huge gap in the national conversation for what New Zealand as a country should do on climate change. There was a lot of great actions that were being done by little communities and even cities. You know, we worked, Gen Zero has done a lot of work around transport and stuff, but yeah, we really wanted something that would be a national level action and a framework. And we got really inspired by what they had done in the UK with the UK's Climate Change Act. And we thought that, you know, just like throwing around ideas, and we thought that that might be a really good idea to bring into New Zealand, because it would be a way, the election was coming, and we wanted to think of a way to do something that was cross-party, that got political consensus behind it as well. And yeah, that was kind of the birth of the idea of the Zero Carbon Act, a national framework that would bind all future governments of New Zealand to climate action, that would legislate targets into law so citizens would be empowered to keep the government to account, and then also have an independent commission that would advise clearly on how to meet our emissions targets and budgets, so the government would be well informed and so would the people. So that was kind of the birth of the idea, and we started doing the groundwork from that, from doing the policy side as well, but then also doing the campaign tactics of as well, focusing in on our message and focusing on building allies as well that would help us.
So what are the main points within the Act then?
The Act has 4 main points. One of the first ones is that it legislates targets into law for 2050. So that's one of the first points. It has a net zero emissions target for all gases, that's methane and carbon dioxide, by 2050. It sets up an independent climate change commission, which advises the government. And it also has stipulations to have adaptation and mitigation plans as well. And another core thing that's really, really important for us for the Zero Carbon Act to include is our obligations under the Te Tiriti, and honouring Te Tiriti while we're thinking about planning ahead in the future.
So I know the public consultation closes on Thursday. How has the feedback and interest been so far from wider New Zealand?
It's been amazing. We've been kind of blown away. We've gathered up to 2,000 submissions through our quick submit form. So a lot of New Zealanders have been getting on board and submitting through there. We've been meeting people on the street and through markets as well, all around the country, and having conversations with them We've also been really, really impressed by small businesses and the business sector coming on board and backing this idea. We had a letter that we did with WWF that around 200 businesses signed up for as well, which is amazing. And on another side is that we've had a lot of great support from the political parties as well, and that includes the National Party. They have changed their tone on the issue, which is a really welcome thing to see, because we really do want it to be a cross-party endeavor. So, yeah, the feedback from New Zealanders and from communities has been great, but I think this is just the first step for us. I think this is hopefully going to lead to a wider and broader conversation around climate change and the things that we have to do in our country as people and as the government, as businesses, to change and to adapt to this issue that we're facing.
So what are we talking about in terms of budgets and timeline for this act then?
So when we talk about budgets and timelines, the budgets are emissions budgets, and they're set over 5 years. This is kind of a methodology that's been taken from the UK as well. And 5 years, it sets it progressively, five interim budgets going up to 2030, and then 5-year targets going up to 2050 as well. And the reason for doing it for over 5 years is that it allows for governments, for the government to signal a clear policy direction going forward into the future. So by having that, you give assurances to not just the people, but then also to the businesses as well and to what they have to do. So that's kind of the idea behind setting the five-yearly budgets for carbon emissions, for all greenhouse gas emissions, I mean.
So Gen Zero spokeswoman Lisa McLaren says the bill needs to be ambitious. Why is it important to start off with this kind of ambition?
It's really important to start off with as ambitious piece of legislation that we can, because the challenge that we're facing is quite steep. The emissions profile for New Zealand has been climbing, and unless we really focus in on the issue and try and achieve some domestic structural change by, you know, doing mixed forestry, changing our agricultural sector, having more public transport, these are really important steps that need to be taken. And if we don't have an ambitious plan, if we don't have a plan that binds us to that, these things will take a longer time. And frankly, we're kind of running out of time because we haven't been sustainable to this point. And if we keep going as business as usual, we're not going to be helping ourselves at all. It's going to be young people like us who are going to be facing the impact of sea level rises, of climate change, much more, at a much greater scale and at a much higher, like, it's a bad way to say it for me personally, but at a much higher cost as well. You know, it's going to definitely impact us in a significant way. So if we can get this bill, the Zero Carbon Bill, which is a cornerstone of action, if we can get it in its best possible version, we're setting ourselves up in a good way to think about the other changes that we need to make going forward.
So what will be the largest challenge in getting this through Parliament?
At the moment, the largest challenge would be ensuring that we get an ambitious plan, that we get a plan that has net zero across all the gases, and it takes a kind of an informed view about how to allocate them. But then I think another big challenge is going to be, and hopefully we're making some headway towards it, but making sure we get cross-party consensus on this. It's really important that all the parties in Parliament at the moment, and the opposition included, get behind this, because this is something that is going to affect us over the long term, and we want this to move beyond just political cycles as well, and not just be back and forth about whether to do action on climate change or not. So if the Zero Carbon Bill is put into law with a big consensus across Parliament, with all political parties voting for it, that will be amazing. But that is going to be a challenge. And I think the thing that we want to encourage your listeners and everybody else to do that we're talking to is go talk to your electorate MP, tell them that this is an issue that you're concerned about, and tell them about the Zero Carbon Act, and tell them about why you feel this is an important piece of legislation, or what you what you value and what you find important about doing action on climate change. And this is the only way we're going to get it. If we tell our MPs and make sure we hold them to account and we tell them that we're watching them, that we want ambition and we want consensus on this issue more than anything, I think that is going to be something that will hopefully help us with that challenge.
And so how will the Māoridom be respected within the Act?
With issues of Māoridom and tangata whenua of Aotearoa, I think one of the most important tenets we feel is really incorporating the principles of partnership when thinking about issues of climate change. So I think we are fortunate to have an amazing document like Te Tiriti to be a foundation stone of this country. And I think going forward, we would love to see a much better partnership model, more than just consultation and just going to go talk to Māoridom and just, you know, doing things together, thinking about incorporating Māori worldviews in thinking about how to deal with some of these issues that are going to be facing us. I think that's going to be really important for us. This is something we are hoping at Generation Zero to hold the government to account on, but this is something that we're learning ourselves as well, and we want to be open. And, yeah, we want to be in a supportive position to make sure that we achieve justice and equity when thinking about climate change, and especially with Māoridom, and especially with people who are going to be the most affected.
So do you have anything else you'd like to add or any further comments?
I would just say that the Zero Carbon Bill is, again, a really important first step that we need to take as New Zealand, as Aotearoa, and having that as a framework that guides our government at a national level is going to impact other parts of our society through how things are funded and how things are planned for. So it's really important that we get involved in this process and we hold the government to account, and if there's an opportunity, then definitely go talk to your MP, regardless of whatever party that they're in, and tell them that this is of concern to you and you want to see consensus and you want to see action on this issue. I would just encourage people to do that.
The Wire. I don't know. And frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
All right, now let's have a look at the latest developments in the United States, where Donald Trump is making some waves. America is freaking out after United States President Donald Trump remarkably caved to Russian head of state Vladimir Putin in Helsinki on Monday.
The United States has been foolish. I think we've all been foolish. I think we're all to blame. I think that the probe is a disaster for our country. I think it's kept us apart. It's kept us separated. There was no collusion at all.
A number of newspapers are actually calling Trump's action treason, and political commentators and journalists are still stunned by what they witnessed. So what happened? Well, as part of Trump's tour of Europe, the US president met with Russia's leader with the initial goal of talking about international affairs and mutual cooperation, with topics like the war in Syria, how to handle North Korea, or the extension of the New START nuclear treaty between the states and Russia, and of course, the Russian meddling in the 2016 US election. The two heads of state privately conversed for about 2 hours before facing the press together, and when asked if he believed US intelligence agencies' conclusion that Russia had interfered in the campaign, Donald Trump surprisingly sided with Russia.
I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this, I don't see any reason why it would be.
This happens only a few days after special counsel Robert Mueller indicted 12 Russian intelligence officers, accusing them of interference and charging them with conspiracy to commit computer crimes and identity theft. A report compiled by the CIA, NSA, FBI, and Office of the Director of National Intelligence concluded with high confidence to Russian interference. Even the Republican-led Senate Intelligence Committee agrees. And instead of acknowledging these findings, Trump did a Trump. He blamed the Democrats and the media and called the investigation a witch hunt, damaging the relationship between the two countries. And it gets worse. When Vladimir Putin offered to send his own government people to look into the meddling and interrogate the indicted officers, Trump said it was an incredible offer and an interesting idea. Oddly enough, he failed to mention completely independent and non-biased. Ever since the election, Donald Trump has been subjected to some pretty hefty criticism. But what comes as a surprise today is how many of his longtime supporters strongly disagree with his attitude. Top Republicans who never disagree with the president came forward to share their disagreement. House Speaker Paul Ryan said there was no question Russia had interfered. And former Speaker and fierce Trump supporter Newt Gingrich called it the most serious mistake of his presidency. Even the ever-supportive conservative TV channel Fox News had some pretty harsh words.
You have been watching perhaps one of the most disgraceful performances by an American president at a summit in front of a Russian leader, certainly that I've ever seen, an extraordinary press conference.
I'll give the benefit of the doubt to maybe jet lag and time differences, but holy tamale. And that's what made it disgusting. That's what made his performance disgusting. I'm sorry, it's just the only way I feel. It's not a right or left thing to me, it's just wrong. That sets us back a lot.
And I have never seen an American president simply surrender to the leader of Russia. You should call this the Surrender Summit.
Remember, this is an American president standing in the summit in Helsinki with really an adversary that the U.S. intelligence community believes is doing a lot of bad things. Clearly, the president wants to score points and to try to make a relationship that handles Syria and other big issues of the day. But he wanted to find a way out of that answer.
The shock of seeing the American president standing next to Vladimir Putin and essentially taking his side against American intelligence was stunning.
The backlash was so strong that it forced Trump to backpedal, saying he misspoke. When Trump said,
He just said it's not Russia. I will say this, I don't see any reason why it would be.
The president actually meant wouldn't be. Trump is not so subtly trying to change the United States' relationship with Russia from enemy to friend. Throughout his Europe tour, Trump repeatedly criticized historical US allies, insulting German Chancellor Angela Merkel and UK Prime Minister Theresa May. He also called the European Union a foe when it came to trading. Yet when facing Russia, all Trump had to share were praise. Trump is yet again shaking years of established international relations, but it's unsure whether this newly shaping alliance with Russia will be met by his supporters with the same enthusiasm as Trump's previous grand changes.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Indeed it is. We will be right back after this.
Darren, what's all this nonsense? It's camping. I told you to only pack the essentials.
It is the essentials. Undies, baked beans, a modem, a router, sunscreen, and 800 metres of Ethernet cabling.
The internet is modern essential. Don't settle for second best with yours. Get Orcon. Orcon's unlimited fibre plans start at just $84.95 a month. Or go crazy fast with the gigantic plan for just $99.95 a month. Visit Orcon at orcon.net.nz. Terms and conditions apply.
Ah, doesn't that salt on your skin feel so good? The enriching, invigorating freshness? We all come from the sea, you know.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Let's race out to the pontoon. I'm going to be young forever.
Where are you going? Ray, don't go outside in your Speedo.
The fish are my sisters.
7 a.m. swim. He kohoi a te whetu karaka I te ata with Sperber Dan. It's got life advice, culture and politics, philosophical musings. It's got features out the wazoo. The 7 a.m. swim, every Saturday morning only on 95BFM. Hi.
The Wire.
More than 500 police officers have resigned from the police force. Most of these are senior police officers. This might be a problem as the government is trying to meet its goal of recruiting 1,800 extra police recruits. With the lack of senior police officers in the force, there will be fewer mentors for these new recruits. With the current attrition rate at 5.4%, there is a possibility this rate may potentially increase if more police officers continue to resign. To find out more about this, I spoke to Chris Cahill from the Police Association. I also spoke to Minister of Police Stuart Nash to find out how they plan to meet their goal of getting new recruits while these police officers resign. Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about why the senior police officers are leaving the force and what's been going on around that?
Police always have an attrition rate of around about 4%, but when it's over that 5 to 5.4% now, it's starts to become alarming because that means we need another 500 new officers a year just to retain the staffing levels now. And the reason that they're going, some is simply because they're reaching retirement age, but a significant number are burnt out. They've been working on the front line, they've got a lack of resources, an increase in demand for to go to jobs such as family harm incidents have increased dramatically, mental health incidents have increased dramatically, and it becomes very wearing and just wears them down. And they're not seeing any relief at this stage.
So you said lack of resources and, you know, some other issues are the one of the factors for them leaving. Is the government not funding enough money into this area?
So the government has come to the party with a significant boost in staffing, but it's a matter of getting those out there and on the front line. But if we're losing as many officers as we're recruiting, which is to some degree what's happening at the moment, then we're not actually getting ahead and we're really just holding the status quo. So it needs to be two-pronged. Get the recruiting going, which is working really well, but retain the staff you've got. And one of the other issues for those senior staff, especially in places like Auckland, is that they are telling us they simply can't afford to live on their current salary. Their mortgages, the cost of childcare, transport has just increased so much that they have to either look to move out of Auckland or to look for higher paying work, and that's what's happening.
So the government has set a target of 1,800 new recruits over the next 3 years. Do you think this goal is achievable with, you know, I think over 500 police officers leaving a year?
Look, they're doing a really good job of recruiting. They're recruiting a lot of recruits and they're recruiting really high quality recruits. So I think we can get those new numbers, but the problem is to handle the attrition rate, you actually need to recruit 3,000 new officers, and that becomes very hard. And if the attrition rate gets higher, suddenly you need to recruit 3,500, and that becomes, you know, starts to get into the, you know, very hard range. So it, you know, it needs to be, as I say, two-pronged. Not just recruiting, need to make sure we retain the staff that we do have. And importantly, we need those senior staff to mentor, guide and train the new staff.
So with these senior police officers leaving the force, do you think this will affect the new recruits coming in?
Yeah, look, I certainly think it will. They need these experienced officers to be there for them. Policing's a job that you actually learn on the job, and having an experienced officer that can take you through some of the pitfalls, pass on what they've learned over their career, is vital, especially when you're dealing with some very volatile situations such as people high on meth or mental harm incidents that can be very dangerous and very stressful. Having that experienced hand to guide you is incredibly important.
You said that we need at least 3,000 new officers to, you know, match the target that the government has set. Are we actually seeing an interest in young people or like any people in our community wanting to join the force?
You know, that is the good news. There's been, I think, 5,000 applicants since November last year, and they're a really diverse mix of New Zealanders and really good quality people. So that's the great news. Now we just got to make sure that as we get them through into the police, they've got those senior people there to support them.
So what incentives do you think the government should set out then to, you know, keep the police force intact and, you know, stop the attrition rate from going too high?
Well, they need to look at workloads. They need to make sure that a significant proportion of these new officers are going onto the frontline 24/7 staff who are really feeling the stress. They also need to look at some wider issues around job sharing, flexible employment options for older members so that they remain in the job longer. But also they need to recognise that we are losing officers because of the current salaries, and they need to make a significant increase in those as well.
I hear that you're currently entering negotiations to increase pay and wages for the police officers. Is there like a ideal rate you guys are going for, or like a certain increase?
Look, we will talk to police about that and negotiate in good faith. We would like to think that they recognise that points the other public servants are making are valid in policing as well. and that gives a guide for what our members would be thinking. But every workplace is slightly different, and we will negotiate in good faith and do that with them privately. But we'd like to think that they understand the need to address this issue.
So you said the current attrition rate is somewhere between 4-5% and 5%, which is high in for police. Do you think there's a possibility that this could increase?
Yeah, the current attrition rate, according to police, is 5.4%, and that is trending up from as low as 4% a few years ago. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but every 1% increase is another 100 officers you have to recruit. So, you know, that 5.4% represents about 500 police officers or 8 new recruit wings every year just to maintain the current numbers.
What you get in a police, in any organisation of 10,000 people, you will get some who decide to retire, some who decide to go and do something else, and others for whom, you know, the police service is not the job they thought it was. So at 5%, 5 or 6% attrition, it is one of the lowest in the state sector. And you know, this is what we expect. And whilst it's always, you know, it's always a shame to lose dedicated officers and experienced officers, this is nothing unusual that happens in the service.
It's interesting that you say that the attrition rate at 5 to 6% is low, because I spoke to Chris Cahill from the Police Association earlier, and he said usually the police attrition rate is between 4 to 5%, and so at 5%, and it's slowly increasing, aren't you afraid that it might keep going higher?
I certainly was afraid when I took this portfolio over, and the reason I say that is in the last workplace survey, 60% of officers said they had an undue level of workplace stress, and 40% of officers said they weren't meeting the and only 40% of officers said they were meeting the promises they were making to their communities. So what we had is a group of very dedicated men and women who knew what needed to be done to keep our community safe, but just didn't have the resources to do it. And it is the reason why a very important part of the coalition agreement is 1,800 new officers over 3 years. So I am concerned about the level of stress that our police officers are facing, and I am concerned about the lack of resources to really prevent crime and keep us safe. But as we, you know, as we roll out these 1,800 officers over 3 years, and including 485 back office staff, I think the level of stress will hopefully decrease, and I'm hoping that police officers will feel as if they do have the resources to meet the promises that they're making to their community.
So what are you going to do to combat the lack of resources available and the stress that police officers are experiencing?
Yeah, what we're doing is we're putting 1,800 more police. It's the largest increase in the New Zealand Police Service ever. So 1,800 more police, more frontline officers we're delivering over 3 years, and 485 back office staff. And that's basically as fast as we can train them. We're putting them into our communities. And that's a slightly under 20% increase in the New Zealand Police Service, and I'm relieved the stress on current officers. So as we get more police onto the front line, it will the stress on current staff.
Okay. As you've been saying, you want 1,800 extra police on the street. How will you achieve this goal then?
So at the moment, the Royal New Zealand Police College at Pararua is very full. We're trialling for the first time since the 1970s, a cohort in Auckland. So it looks like we're going to train between 1,000 and 1,100 in the 12 months since we became government. But we are actively recruiting fantastic men and women to join the service, and we're making sure that we're training the numbers to get them out there.
Are you getting enough interest amongst younger people or people wanting to join the police force to make up for these numbers?
Yeah, we are. We're getting a fantastic level of interest. And it is it's a career that is like no other. Yeah, so what this is it's a career less ordinary, that there's no doubt. So, you know, what the men and women who join the police service don't do is sit behind a desk all day. They're out in the community, they're preventing crime, they're solving crime. It really is a very wide and varied job. It's a fantastic career for anyone who's thinking of joining. And now is the time. You know, one thing that I'm committed to, and I know the commissioner is making our police service more representative of the communities they serve. So, you know, the ultimate aspirational goal is to have the police service at 50% women, 17% Māori, 15% Pacifica, 10% Asian, you know, absolutely representative of the communities they serve. So if there are people listening who are keen to join the service, then, you know, we're very keen to have you.
With the new recruits you're getting, and I guess the senior police officers you're losing, do you think that's affecting the quality of new recruits coming in because they're not having this mentor there as well?
No, I don't think it's affecting it at all. In fact, I've been to every single graduation except one since I have been the minister, and the quality of the men and women coming through is absolutely superb. You know, most of them have degrees these days. Some of them have represented New Zealand in various sports. There was a person last time who spoke 9 languages. You know, the age ranges vary. Last time the youngest was 18 and I think the oldest was 41. And so, you know, there's a wide range of people who are coming in, and a lot of them have some significant life experience as well. You know, it's not, you know, we're always sad to say goodbye to experienced officers, of that there's no doubt. But, you know, some of those who are leaving the service are now 65. Some of them have done 40 years in policing. And so they feel as if it's time to retire and go and do other things. But, you know, it's sad to lose them. But what I can say is we are getting some fantastic people coming in and replacing them.
So the police association, they're entering, I think, is it wage negotiations? Do you think that will affect new recruits, or that could possibly be influencing the high attrition rate?
Yeah, I'm not too sure what tactics the police association are going to use in their salary negotiations. And obviously that negotiation is between Commissioner Mike Bush's team and head of the police association, Chris Cahill's team. And, you know, I'm obviously not a party to that negotiation at all. And so, you know, I'm not too sure of the tactics that are going to be used in that.
We don't agree with violence. We do not agree with the government. We do.
The Wire.
All right, that brings us to that brings us to the end of the show for another week. You will find us, all three of us, back here in the studio next week, and obviously The Wire comes back tomorrow with Lachlan. In the meantime, big thanks to all those who spoke with us today on the show: Alan Blackman, Sid Mehta, Chris Gale, and Stuart Nash. Big thank you to today's producer Dara Spreet and Harry, and obviously thank you listeners for tuning in. That's all for today. Bridges up with the 1 to 4, and you're listening to 95 BFM.